Welcome to the Sound Bath with me, Angelina Kalahari, your host for the next hour. The Sound Bath's objective is to talk about and listen to music, with particular emphasis on the human vocal instrument, in an informative, educational, and questioning manner. Recently, I had the wonderful opportunity to chat to Todd Makover via Skype from my little computer room in London, where you can hear the birds singing in the garden and London Underground going by, so it's all very rustic. But despite the distractions, or enhancements, as I'd like to call them, Todd spoke with great enthusiasm, joy and generosity about his music. And so it was a particular treat for me to speak with a living opera composer. So before we listen to the interview, a little background on Todd. He was born in New York in 1953. He is widely recognised as one of the most significant and innovative composers of his generation, and is also celebrated for inventing new technology for music, including hyperinstruments, which he launched in 1986. Todd studied with two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning American composer Elliot Carter, and also with well-known American composer Roger Sessions at the Juilliard School, and he was the first director of musical research at Pierre Boulez's IRCAM in Paris. IRCAM is the Institute for Research and Coordination of Acoustic Music, and it is one of the world's largest public research centres dedicated to both musical expression and scientific research. Todd has also been Professor of Music and Media at the MIT Media Lab in Cambridge, America, since it was founded in 1985, and he is the Director of the Lab's Hyperinstruments and Opera of the Future groups. Since 2006, he has also been Visiting Professor of Composition at the Royal Academy of Music in London.
What does it matter? Simulation, face, medium, voice, face, space, as many as I want, faces and voices. I am almost purely and entirely into the system. I'm really out of matter, but maybe I'm not out of time.
Welcome to the Sound Bath, Todd. It's fantastic to have you with us, and I hope this will be the first of many chats with you about your wonderful music. So before we start, please allow me to congratulate you on your recent award. Can you tell us what it was for, please?
Yes, that's the one. I think you mean the award from the World Technology Network?
That's right. Yes.
Well, that's actually one of the nice kinds of things, because it's something that I wasn't aware of. And the World Technology Network is an association based in New York that's was started by a group of people associated with CNN and Time Magazine. And it's an organization that tries to recognize people who've made a contribution through technology to a wide variety of fields. So it recognizes people in the arts, but in innovation and design and in industry and in politics and all kinds of different fields. And people are elected to this organization and then nominate people for the award. So it's by nomination, and I won the award this year in the arts, which is very
nice. That's fantastic.
Nice.
Yeah,
I was, I guess, nominated by peers and wasn't told about it until I was called at the last minute and asked if I could come to New York. And
that's
so it's actually kind of a nice thing. It's a very interesting, really a wide range of innovators. So it was a nice group to be part of.
Yeah. What a fab thing to do, to have though, right?
it's nice. And I think the nicest part is is that it was anonymous and something that I had no idea about. So that's always the nicest kind of recognition.
Yeah. Oh, great. Well, I'm very pleased for you. And so I just want to ask you, you've invented hyper instruments, which obviously sounds very interesting and conjures up pictures of very excitable musical instruments running around. But what are they actually? it'd be interesting just to know sort of what they are and how they might be different from other instruments.
Yeah, I think the best way to put them in context is to say that I grew up in New York, and I kind of have a hybrid background. My mom is a pianist and actually a wonderful music, still is a wonderful music teacher who combines piano teaching with allowing young people to enter into creative music activities. And my dad is a technologist, and he's one of the first people in the field of computer graphics. And so I kind of grew up with creative music and music performance and technology in the house, and I was, I guess, always interested in putting those together. And I'm a cellist, so I grew up really not only playing the cello, but the whole feel of that particular instrument that has a range from the lowest sounds that a voice can make to the highest sounds and everything in between, and does very melodic and very gestural. It's very central to what I think about. And when Sgt. Pepper's came out, you know, the Beatles in 1967, I was a young teenager, and that really electrified me literally in a lot of ways. I pretty much listened mostly to classical music before then, and chamber music and vocal music. And so Sgt. Pepper's was just so exciting to me musically, you know, the fact that it was so beautiful, and it was so direct and also complex at the same time, and had so many layers of sound. And one thing that really struck me at that point was that it was the first album that the Beatles made that was designed to be made in a recording studio, and could only be made in a recording studio. And that was, of course, the moment that they decided not to perform live anymore. Yeah. You know, they'd gotten fed up with performing in larger and larger venues. The Shea Stadium concert was famous because they couldn't hear themselves, and they were playing out of tune, and it just wasn't fun anymore.
Yeah.
And they also had a vision with George Martin of what you could do in a studio if you could layer every sound bit by bit and bring together you know, traditional instruments, but also sounds of machines and sounds of nature and sounds from synthesizers, things that really could only be done in a studio. And so what struck me, besides loving the music, was the fact that this was a very exciting thing to be able to do with technology in a recording studio, but also, wouldn't it be even better if you could do this kind of music and do it live as well?
Right.
Something really was lost if you couldn't make music with human beings staring at each other face to face, whether it was a performers on stage with an audience, or jamming with friends, or improvising with friends. So I guess since that time, I really was obsessed with the idea of having the best of both worlds, having to combine the richness of technology for you know, the presence of the music, the complexity and the layering, with the immediacy and spontaneity and gesture of live performance. And in a nutshell, that's what hyper instruments are. I thought about this for a long time. I went to Juilliard to study composition, learned technology along the way, went to Paris to work at the Pompidou Center at IRCOM with Pierre Boulez when that opened up. And all the time I had in mind, how could you make a performance environment where the natural musicianship of anybody who came to play could be enhanced and expanded, and that's what a hyper instrument is. It sometimes we use traditional instruments, sometimes we use things that are like traditional instruments, sometimes we invent totally new instruments, but the idea is that the instrument knows what is being played, and even more importantly, how it's being played, what the feeling is, what the intention is, so that just by interpreting the music in a particular way, by bringing out an F sharp or driving a phrase to a downbeat or letting it all relax, those emotions of performance are understood by the instrument, and so what you play can be a window onto a much bigger world. The cello might turn into a voice, or into a trumpet, or into a sound you never heard before.
Right.
Or a melodic line might all of a sudden turn into a counterpoint and into an orchestra, all shaped by the way it's being played. And so in a nutshell, that's what a hyper instrument is.
That's fascinating, isn't it? It's like artificial intelligence almost. Is it?
It is actually. The instruments need to have some kind of artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
We do a lot of that work to understand what the music is, and so that's all part of it.
Gosh, yes. Well, that is fascinating. So just following on from that, but on a slightly different tack, I read in the Los Angeles Times that you were called America's most wired composer.
Yeah.
So for those of us who are unfamiliar with the term wired composer, could you please explain what that means?
Yeah, well, I think it's not a common term. I think it was coined for this occasion. But I think primarily what it meant was that kind of serious classical composers, I've probably, really become one of the people who's most associated with wired in the sense of using technology, incorporating it into musical expression and into my compositions,
right.
And, to try to take the potential of technology and meld it with musical possibilities and bring that into the mainstream. So I think wired literally in the sense of music connected to computers, connected to technology, wired in that, I think that's the way it was meant. And of course these days it's wireless because
I came from light and I will return to
does have a certain density and probably energy to it, so both with the hyper instruments and maybe with the wired, maybe there's some of that implication as well, although I write a lot of music which is calm and delicate as well. I hope that's a full range is what I'm trying to
yeah do. Well, I think you certainly achieve it in your opera compositions. So, I mean, obviously, you're particularly known for those. So I wanted to ask you who or what inspired you to write opera compositions in particular?
A good question. Actually, when I was growing up, I wasn't particularly an opera fan at all. That mm-hmm. wasn't the first music that I was drawn to. And
right.
again, I think maybe because I'm a cellist and maybe because my mom is a pianist, I always growing up was more drawn to chamber music and small ensemble solo music. My parents were also, I think because my mom was interested in music creativity, my dad was into technology. We also listened to a lot of very edgy experimental music. So in the 60s, we listened to some of the early electronic music.
Mm-hmm.
I liked rock music. And opera felt pretty foreign to me. But because my music has always been dramatic, it's always been about human experience. It's not abstract music. It's always been very emotional music.
Right.
I've always thought of my compositions, even from when I was, a kid,
yeah.
as music that would take people on a journey.
Right.
If it's music without words, it takes you on an emotional journey. You're not quite sure what the storyline is, but I've always been conscious of there being a storyline. So it was
right.
kind of natural that I wanted to incorporate words little by little. So I've always written melodic music. I've always been interested in music with words. Because I've always wanted to really capture people's imaginations. I've been interested in images and bringing more and more aspects of the senses and of a full experience into my compositions.
Right.
And so little by little, probably starting, 25 years or so ago, I started thinking about kind of inventing my own kind of opera. So when I started writing opera, the first opera I wrote was on commission from the Pompidou Center for their 10th anniversary. It was premiered at the end of 1987. It was an opera called Valis.
Right.
And at that time, the Pompidou Center asked me if I wanted to make a special composition, if I wanted to do something that might incorporate different media. And I really sort of rethought what an opera might be based on the kind of story I wanted to tell and the kind of resources I wanted to use.
Right.
And so each project I've done, I haven't really thought about Wagner or Mozart as a model and how can I adapt that. I've thought about how can I tell a story, how can I immerse an audience, how can I take them on a journey, how can I use words and image and sound and music to tell the story I wanted to. And one of the great things about opera is that it's always been a very dynamic and very adaptable form, in some ways more than the symphony, for instance, or more than even a string quartet. Opera has been, opera just means work, and it's always been a form where composers in their time have taken the resources around them and told stories with music at the core. And so I've actually found it a very liberating form. And it's allowed me to write different operas, which each one of them, in terms of the resources it uses and the way it sounds and the way it tells the story and the way it looks, has been appropriate to the story that I wanted to tell. And they're really quite different from each other. And it's been a great form to create in, I think.
That is fascinating, because, of course, it's very seldom that we get to talk to opera composers, exactly. So to find out, how they create it, because, sometimes when I talk to people who have never been to an opera, for example, they can't understand how, as an artist, you even learn it. So imagine writing it,
I know it's true, but I think a really good thing for people to remember is that, of course, all of these musical forms are alive because people are passionate about them and people want to make new ones. And I really do think that because opera's always been a hybrid, you think of Wagner's idea of Gesamtkunstwerk, that opera, like film, is a way to bring all the media together. Opera is exciting because music is what holds it together. And I actually think that that opera is a very active and dynamic form right now, particularly in a place like London, where you have the Covent Garden, the Royal Opera House, putting on an opera about Anna Nicole Smith's life, and that's you don't see that on Broadway, for instance. I mean, that's an interesting thing. And I don't know if you know the theater group Punch Drunk. They're a young theater group based in London who I admire a great deal, and they specialize in theater experiences where there's no fixed narrative on stage that all audience members see at the same time. They make narrative. They make theater experiences where the audience has to wander through complex spaces like a warehouse, and each audience member has a different experience.
Right.
So they directed an opera with the English National Opera this last year.
Yeah.
I think opera is a very interesting place to make new work right now, and so it's very alive and well, and I'm happy to be working in this medium.
And we're happy for you to be there. It's wonderful, because I've listened to all your operas and they are fantastic, and hopefully you'll come back and talk to us about all of them. But I just wanted to ask you also, in order to be able to write for singers, does that mean you needed to study a little bit of singing or voice?
That's a really good question. I think that definitely to write for any instrument, but particularly for voice, you have to understand it from the inside. And I guess I always think, this may be a bit of a perverse thing to say, but I always think that it's an advantage to be quite good at something, but not too good at something.
Okay.
I think if you're too good, if you're, for instance, if I love singing, and I'm an okay singer, but I'm not, I have no pretension to being a professional singer. In fact, I've got two teenage daughters, and You know, they're pretty finicky about singing. I'm always a little self-conscious to sing around them because they're very picky about singing.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think if you're too good at something, then often you don't understand the difficulties and the limits, and you just have to think about how something works.
Right.
You know, if you're really not good at something and you don't understand it at all, then it's probably very difficult to make it your own. So you don't want to be a total novice. If you're completely a natural genius, like if you're just one of these people who was born with a brilliant singing voice and absolutely have no hesitation to soar from one end of the range to the other, and you know, maybe it's, first of all, maybe you might fall into cliches because you're so aware of everything that anybody has ever done with the voice, and maybe a lot of the ideas that come to you might, without you realizing it, might be borrowed from what other people have sung or what other people have imagined. So I think I understand the voice. I love to sing. I understand melody very well. I think from the cello is where I kind of grew up playing melodies and just feeling what it means to shape a melody so that it just has what you want. You know, it has a dynamism to it. It has a rise and fall. It's not too long. It's not too short. It keeps you, all those kind of things. And I think I know just enough about the voice to imagine and to feel what it would be like for somebody to sing my melodies, but not too much so that I take for granted, I think I can think freshly about the voice and push it in slightly new ways and also be very aware of what's difficult and not. I think I'm not afraid to make things challenging when I need to, but also know where to lay off and so anyway, I guess that's, I think maybe in my experience there's a sweet spot where I know enough but not too much.
That's probably a really good place to be. And I think also, I mean, string instruments are quite comparable to the vocal instrument, to the human vocal instrument, isn't it? I mean, especially the cello. I've heard this before from other cellists where they've talked about that. But can I just ask you, so what kind of voices do you prefer for your work? And sort of how do you choose those kind of voices, or do you not really get involved in that aspect of it?
No, it's a great question. I do very much get involved in that. And and again, this is an area where I love to make, I'm always involved in casting my pieces. I usually have a very strong feeling about the kind of voices I look for. Okay. And I also love to collaborate with, depending on the project, with somebody else or some, you know, not just myself in making some of these choices. And it depends on the project because, you know, it could be, for instance, in Death and the Powers, the most recent opera, there were two people above all who I often traded ideas with about who to select for voices. One was the director, Diane Paulus, and she's a theatrical director who happens to have a very strong sense of singing and also of the combination of singing and acting. So the thing about opera, which is different than lieder or different than, maybe similar to rock singing in a way, is that the way, it's, of course, everything to do with the voice and the vocal quality and the shaping of phrases, but the presence of a singer as a character and as an actor on stage is complex, and it's very much a part of how successful that singer is in the opera. So it's not just the voice, it's not just the acting. The other person for Death and the Powers who I spent a lot of time back and forth with is Brian Dickey, who is the director, the executive director of Chicago Opera Theater, and is one of the great kind of producers in opera. He was head of Glyndebourne Opera for a long time and the Canadian Opera Company. And he just has that special sense of this combination of singing and acting, which will make a particular person just shine on stage. Yeah. That said, back to this idea of thinking about opera, kind of my kind of opera, opera from first principles, rather than trying to make opera that sounds or looks like other people's operas. Yeah. I always have a very particular idea of the kinds of voices that I want for my projects, and it's different from opera to opera. Often in a particular opera, I might cast singers from different backgrounds in the same opera. Actually, it's not so much true in Death and the Powers, although There are a couple of singers in Death and the Powers who were specialists in early music rather than in traditional 19th century opera. I'm often drawn to people who are fantastic in early music because of the purity of the singing, lack of huge vibrato, just a kind of directness. And there's certain kinds of roles that I like to cast for early music singers. Sometimes I look to people, you know, I love casting people who are either leader singers or even, you know, I always look for people who know how to sing rock music, although it's it's often difficult to find really terrific rock singers who are, you know, can sing complicated music and can read music and can fit in with, you know, my music, especially rhythmically, is often, you know, it changes time signature quite often. You really have to be able to follow a complicated background, even if it ends up sounding very direct. You need a fairly high level of musicianship. But in general, I like singers who have perfect and beautiful voices, but also have a very unaffected and direct way of connecting with an audience. Some opera singers absolutely have that, but a lot of opera singers have trained to project in a very, very large hall, you know, 2,000 plus audience members, unamplified, and often to project in that environment, you have to exaggerate everything you're doing. I'm not saying this is a criticism, it's just part of the profession. The greatest opera singers know how to project in that kind of superhuman way and still remain very simple and direct. But for me, a lot of that kind of projection leads to just leads to a musical sound and also to a kind of acting technique, which often doesn't suit what I'm looking for. So I like people who have this beautiful voice and also a very simple, direct, a way that you almost forget that they're singing when they're on stage. I'll look anywhere I need to find that kind of singer.
That's fantastic. That's really, really interesting, because of course, I think, you know, sometimes you speak to people, as I said before, who have never been to an opera and stuff, and that's what they feel uncomfortable with, the huge voices, the huge, so it's fantastic to find someone like you who is a composer of opera and are looking to other voices to fit in with the opera. You know, that's kind of really refreshing to hear. That's fantastic. But I just wanted to ask you, I mean, since the demise, as we're talking about the opera, you know, the big singers, since the demise of the opera's golden age, apparently singers' voices are no really longer the drawing card they once were for audiences to attend opera. Do you feel then perhaps that singers' bodies on stage have become more the visual medium for portraying the story of the opera, whilst their voices have perhaps become more to feature as an ensemble alongside the orchestra, like almost like an instrument? Do you feel that way?
Yeah, I understand. I think certainly if you go to the to the major opera houses in the world, there certainly are marquee singers. You know, some of them are based in a particular city, some of them are quite international, and there are certainly still, you know, many people who love opera, not just because of the sound of the voice, but because of the personality or the, you know, dynamism of a particular singer. So I know we're not in the, you know, in the golden age when, you know, that was the absolute top ticket item. But I don't think that culture has completely disappeared. What I do think is that I think what's a very positive thing is that the idea that opera really should be a unified form where the theatricality and the visuals and the sound and the character and the singer themselves, that this all blends together. I think the most successful projects are the ones where each of these elements is vivid and strong. I love project where singers are just off the charts brilliant, and people come and are, you know, I think of Death and the Powers, you know, every one of the singers, they except maybe for the main character James Maddalena, who's quite a well-known baritone, you know, most of the others were actually rather young singers, so you're absolutely right that people wouldn't have come to the opera because they knew the name ahead of time. But I'm certain that many people hearing the performances, you know, hopefully they were immersed in the total experience, but I know many people were absolutely taken with one performer or another. And actually, one of the nice things about Death in the Powers in particular is that I think different people associated with different singers. You know, there were maybe a couple who everybody was wowed by.
Yeah.
But I would talk to different audience members, and almost each individual person would come with a different singer who you know, they would go out of their way of mentioning that, oh, you know, this tenor was just, I was really taken with that particular voice and that character, and or the soprano or the baritone. And so I do think that there's a very healthy trend to maybe to stay away from the star system about, you know, the performers themselves being the story.
Right.
And the theatrical experience, everything together being the most important thing. But, you know, it's opera after all. And I do not think that you want the singers to fade away into an ensemble. I think you want them to be real characters on stage, and you want characters to be vivid through everything, through the, through the physical gesture and the look and the, you know, the direction, but also in the way that the character comes alive as a person, and the way the voice works. Ideally you want all these things to blend together, but you want each one to be absolutely fantastic on its own.
That's fantastic. I mean, I can understand exactly what you're saying. And actually, talking about Death in the Powers, it has been called a robotic opera. Mm. How do we, the listeners, understand robotic in that context?
Well, actually, it's in a pretty large context in Death in the Powers. One of the original ideas I had when I first started thinking about this particular opera, we talked a little bit before about hyper instruments, where I mentioned how you could give a human performer on stage the ability to expand his or her musicality, so that you could control a whole world of sound out of one instrument. Mm-hmm. One thing I started thinking about with Death in the Powers is how that same kind of idea has not translated in the past 20 years or so well into stagecraft itself, what you see on stage, and into the physical experience of being in the theater. Mm-hmm. In many ways, live theater, and opera included, hasn't found a very good way to become part of the digital age. The staging of many operas may be wonderful, but it's still fairly conservative. It still looks like theater looked a long time ago.
Right.
And if you think about the way technology is often incorporated into live performance in general these days, I think of a rock concert. I have teenage daughters. I go to more arena rock concerts than I would if I didn't have teenage daughters. And you go to these concerts these days, and most successful bands really can't afford to play in intimate settings anymore. So the venues get larger and larger, the amplification systems get gigantic and really not very pleasant. You know, you're having enormous sound kind of just pushed at you in these venues. And on stage, these stages are so big that you have to have usually a large, either one or many big screens. Right. And usually the screens are showing close-ups of the artist's facial expressions, or maybe the hands on the guitars, or maybe they're just showing graphics that go along with the song.
Yeah.
And what I find is the larger and larger the blow-ups become, the smaller and smaller the people become. So, even if you go to like a U2 show these days, I mean, they're very good performers.
Yeah.
But the human beings on stage look like little ants running around. It doesn't augment the human presence. It shrinks it. And so one of the things I was thinking of, even before we had a story with this opera, was how could we use the technology to enhance the presence of the performers on stage, just like we do with our hyper instruments, and how can we make the stage itself, the physical stage, help tell the story? And how can we make the fact that the stage is telling the story make us feel closer to the human beings rather than further away?
Right.
And when I started thinking about that, I started thinking, well, if we have a stage coming alive, some way, a stage moving, maybe dancing in the air, dancing on stage, that is kind of what a robot is. What's a robot? A robot is something physical that's not a human being that mm-hmm. is taking on some kind of animate characteristics. And mm-hmm. so I started thinking that some way of making the stage robotic, or making robots be present on stage, and making that be exciting, and maybe making it move towards an experience where we would think about the relationship between human beings, how technology can enhance human capability, and maybe what the limits are, where a human ends and where technology starts, where, you know, is that blurry somewhere? Are they going to become the same thing in one? And at one point, no, they're not going to become one thing. Well, why not? That became very core to the subject. And so we started thinking about different ways to make robots that would be part of this project. And then the other totally parallel idea I had at the beginning of Death and the Powers was just about aging and mortality and legacy. I mean, you know, I'm right. middle-aged, and just for myself, I'm just, you know, just thinking about the kind yeah. of cycle of life. But even more than that, I was thinking about my own parents getting older, mm-hmm. and in particular, the relationship across generations between my parents and my children, and right. simply just the simple fact of, you know, we have a very close family, and just the kind of poignant fact of how close I am to my parents, and how close I am to my teenage daughters, right. and how difficult it is over the generation for my daughters really ever to know my parents as in the same way that I do. It's just a fact. And,
right.
And so what it means to communicate and to, mm-hmm. to kind of share the texture of any life, of any of our lives, with anybody else, with anybody that we're close to, yeah. How we do that, on a day-to-day basis, how we do it, you know, through our families and especially across generations, and are there different ways to share, you know, what our life is, what do we want to share,
right.
what are the limits of what we can share, and what frankly are the limits of what everybody else wants us to share. I mean, it would be, you know, there's kind of an obsession, I think, these days because of technology,
mm-hmm.
With trying to capture everything that we do. I mean, we do it through Facebook. We do, you know, there actually yeah. are people, I think it's especially common in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, there's a whole movement of people who want to live forever and simply don't want to face the idea that at some point we're not going to be here. So,
yeah.
you know, can technology preserve us forever? There are also people who are trying to document everything about themselves, literally go around with like video cameras 24 hours a day
right.
that capture every single thing that we do. In with the thought that this is going to be kind of a documentation of our lives, and so in the future somebody else, whoever it is going to be able to simply have us around all the time. And you know, I think to me all of these considerations, just the human consideration of how we share what we are with others, mm-hmm. what we can't share, just that poignant thing that anybody deals with, nothing to do with technology,
mm-hmm.
then the obsession with, well, maybe technology can solve this problem for us,
mm-hmm.
Which is on the one hand a kind of, you know, in many ways the very touching extension of our desire to just be here forever. On the other hand, it's very naive and kind of, you know, kind of, I don't know what you want to say. I mean, it's narcissistic or poignant. So this was another aspect that I wanted to be central to this opera. The reason I mentioned it in this context is mm-hmm. that in making the story, and in working with Robert Pinsky, the poet, to formulate this story, these two ideas of robots and legacy and preserving something essential about ourselves, these two things became connected. And so we made up this story about a man who's obsessed partly with living forever, but even mm-hmm. more with this guy, Simon Powers, is actually, he's rich, powerful, successful. He's also kind of, like the situation I just described, he's kind of, you know, I don't know if creepy is the word, but there's something, you know, there's something weird about him as well. I mean, we thought of him as kind of like Bill Gates meets Howard Hughes meets Walt Disney, Steve Jobs, somebody like that. You know, he can do anything he wants,
right.
and he's visionary, but he's also kind of kooky, and there's also something about what he wants which isn't quite right, even though we can. Kind of understand it and associate with it. So
right.
he is actually kind of tired of the world. He wants to leave, but he wants everything about himself to stay. He wants his memories and his personality and his ability to still be in close contact with everybody he loves. And, and he wants to keep manipulating his businesses, but he wants to be gone. And so he invents this thing called the system, and the system allows himself to download himself into his environment. And he, the person, disappears at the end of the first scene of the opera. Right. And the stage, little by little, takes on his characteristics. The stage comes alive, and he's designed these robots, which are kind of his intermediary when he's not there. Right. And so the robots in the opera are everything that he leaves when he disappears. And there actually is a chorus, like a Greek chorus of robots that help tell the story. And they're kind of like any Greek chorus. They're kind of like the intermediary between the story being told on stage and the audience.
Right.
The whole stage itself actually becomes the main character, because the singer's not there anymore for most of the opera. So we measure the singer, actually, Jim Maddalena, goes down into the orchestra pit. We have a special booth built for him.
Right.
And just like a hyper instrument, he sings. Mm. And we measure singing, we measure his body movement, we measure his gesture, we measure his muscle tension, we measure his breathing. So we measure what he's singing, but also the emotion of his performance. And all of this bubbles up on the stage and influences the way the sound changes, the way the sound moves in space, and it influences the way these robots move on stage, and it influences the way the whole set, these gigantic walls, which look like the walls in his room,
right,
but are actually big robots. They're, you know, they're these big three-ton walls that move and spin and show images that are really, we think of them as kind of images of his inner being. They don't look like pictures. They look like light and shadow and gesture on these walls.
Right.
And there's a big chandelier, which looks like a, you know, a light chandelier in his house at the beginning of the opera.
Right.
But it has many strings on it, and these strings vibrate with his voice, and the chandelier comes down from the ceiling and surrounds his wife, Evie, and is actually a big robotic music instrument that has a love scene with his wife. You know, it's one of the world's oddest love scenes, this woman who is speaking to her husband through this chandelier. And so the robotic opera actually means the entire physical world, in which he has tried to leave everything about himself, and the world actually comes alive through technology, and allows all of us to, like the people who are left on stage, to try to decide whether this physical world is actually, it really is him.
Right.
Is it not him? Is there something missing? Mm. Do we like him in this form? Can relate to him in this form? Is this an attractive enough form of existence that maybe we'd like to think about existing in this form?
Right.
Or is there something really not right? And that's what each of the characters face once he leaves, and that's really what the opera's about, and that's what the drama is. What do they choose, and how do they relate to him, and do they follow him, or is there something essential about being human that can't be expressed by a robot? And if so, what do you choose? Do you want to be a robot, or do you want to just be yourself?
Oh, you see.
it's
fascinating, yes. I've actually watched it, and that scene you described with his wife, with the chandelier, that was quite amazing. But what an aria. Beautiful aria.
Thank you. And, and it's funny because his wife, Evie, she loves Simon. And when he leaves, she's the character, as much as she loves him.
Hmm.
She actually finds that there's a way that she can connect to him. You talk about Wired. Through her headphones, through the chandelier, in this new form, that she actually feels very close to him. She has a very special relationship. In fact, she spends the rest, after the scene with the chandelier, she spends the rest of the aria, of the opera, with headphones on stage, hearing things from him that we, the audience, don't hear, the other people on stage don't hear. She answers with a kind of humming back and forth. And so she has a kind of enhanced connection with him through this system, and some people do. It's like my kids, when they spend all day on Facebook in their rooms communicating with people they've never met, there's something about this new world and technology which is very seductive, and also in many ways very dangerous, I think.
Yes, I have to agree with you there. I have to agree with you. It is fascinating to see, how technology has impacted on our lives already. So it's fantastic to know that there's an opera out there that sort of answers those questions or asks the questions even more.
I think it asks those questions and allows people really to feel what the different responses might be, and maybe helps you identify with not one but many many approaches.
That was
Thanks,
fantastic.
brilliant.
Thank you. That was the very sensual love scene aria in which Evie Powers experiences her husband through the chandelier. In order for us to get a better feeling of the opera overall, it's probably a good idea to listen to the next three arias one after the other. So the first one is the very moving aria from Miranda in which she laments the loss of her father, followed by the delicious layers of sound, colour and textures from the aria from the finale, and then we'll go straight to the aria from the epilogue.
Yes. flesh and blood. I need to touch my
I'm Is that it? Is that the show? Where's the rest? I still cannot understand. What is this? Death? Is it a form of waste?
Is this where all things stand? Is it just entropy coming to rest?
And what is meat?
Why choose to suffer? Whatever that means.
Questions are excellent. Units deployed as individuals will receive 1,000 human rights status credits. Now is the time for the ordained ritual to come to rest.
Thank you for listening to The Sound Bath. Join us again next time when we'll have more stimulating glimpses into the worlds of music and words.